So good evening and welcome to what I think is our fourth or fifth annual Haggadah night. I want to thank Bayit Adult Education for hosting once again. I want to thank the maintenance staff for pitching in to help make sure that that people would be able to have chairs. Much appreciated. The format for Haggadah night is straightforward. It's four Divrei Torah, four Torah thoughts that are designed to be usable at the Seder. They're supposed to be no longer than 10 minutes. You can hook the speaker if the speaker runs long. I will note that we have another one tomorrow night at Shai Shemayim at 8 o'clock for different Divrei Torah. Not the same ones as the ones you will hear this evening. The Divrei Torah tonight will follow the order in which they appear in the Haggadah. So Rabbi Spitz will be starting us off. I will be second. I believe Rabbi Ziering is third, and then Adam Friedman will be speaking fourth. There are source sheets around for three out of the four Divrei Torah, and without further ado, I turn over the floor to Rabbi Spitz. Rabbi Spitz, thank you so much. It is always a pleasure to have you with us, and thank you very much for sharing Torah. And no, just for the record, I was not signaling him at all. So, do you also have that relative, the perhaps aunt or uncle or grandparent, who likes to drag out embarrassing stories about you at family gatherings? Does that all ring a bell? You know, the time you went running down the street in pajamas when you were 6 years old, or that kind of story? That's not just me, right? Not that story, but the phenomenon of the relative. We do that at our Seder in the early part of Magid. You see, Magid begins by talking about leaving Egypt, right? We have the four children and the sages in Bnei Brak, and then we get into the actual mitzvah in earnest with the paragraph of Mitchila, in which we quote from the last chapter of the book of Yehoshua, as Yehoshua identifies the Jewish people as descendants of the idolatrous family of Terach. We're going to retell that story that embarrasses you about how way, way back your great-great-grandfather worshipped idols. Now, if you have the sheet that says Haggadah Night, the study of possibility, there are a few sources I'm going to refer to in the course of the Dvar Torah. That opening source is a passage from the Talmud where it talks about what we call maschil b'gnus u'misayim b'shevach, the idea that we are supposed to start out by describing our national disgrace, and then we continue to ultimately achieve our glory. And as the Talmud teaches in source number one, there's a debate about what constitutes our national disgrace. The view of Rav, it says that we are supposed to remember that we started out as idolaters with the family of Terach. The other view is that we start out as slaves, that we were once slaves. So we satisfy Rav. We satisfy the view that says start out by mentioning that we were idolatrous with this paragraph of Mitchila, where we say we come from the family of Terach, this passage from Yehoshua. But why do we tell this, do you remember when, story? Why do we start with Gnus? Why do we want to start with our disgrace? So there are a few classic ideas. One approach is that by starting out by mentioning our national disgrace, that accentuates the high that comes with our growth. Look how far we've come. We started down here, and we ended up here. Another answer brought by the Tosfos Rid about 800 years ago is that it increases our appreciation for what Hashem did for us. When we remember where we started, then we will really appreciate where we've ended up. That's another approach. A third approach from the Maharsha, writing in, I think, the 17th century, maybe the 16th, says that the goal is to keep us humble. Remember your origins. And I think those are all true. I'm not challenging any of them, but I'd like to suggest another idea. And that is that the study of history is the study of possibility. Learning where we've been and how we have come to where we are today shows us our true potential, both positive and, frankly, negative. There was an article online a couple of years ago. Physicists believe they've discovered a way, hypothetically, to unboil an egg. That's considered one of the hardest things to do, right? How do you do that? Once it's already been boiled and the proteins have changed, how in the world can you... They've discovered a way to unboil an egg. And I feel like that's what we're doing here when we talk about where we come from. We look back at our raw egg state, and it's not always pretty, right? The study of history as the study of possibility actually shows up earlier in the book of Yehoshua, in the fifth chapter, and I want to run you through the story quickly. I brought you the relevant passage in source number 3. This story from the fifth chapter in Yehoshua is the beginning of the month of Nisan. The Jews have just crossed the Jordan River, the Yarden. They've entered the land of Israel. They carry out Brit Milah, circumcision, that will enable them to bring the Korban Pesach. After that circumcision, Hashem says to Yehoshua, "Now I have removed the shame of Egypt from upon you." They bring the Korban Pesach, and they finish their supply of the man, and they start eating produce from the land of Israel. What does God mean when He says, "Now I have removed the shame of Egypt from upon you"? So there are a few different answers. I brought you a selection in source number 4. I'm not going to go through them. But there are different approaches to what the shame of Egypt was. But what I'd like to suggest is the following. The shame of Egypt, for us, was that we would be identified as renegade slaves. People who had been slaves in Egypt, who had broken out, and now 40 years later had arrived in the land of Israel. Because that means our national origin is we were slaves, and now we've taken some land. Land that belongs to the Canaanites, right? That's what we would be saying. By having us engage in the Brit Milah and the circumcision, Hashem says that's not the story. Because where does the Brit Milah begin? Where does it begin? Abraham and Sarah, right? That generation. It's Abraham's family that engages in the Brit Milah, that engages in circumcision. They lived in that land. So by engaging in this ritual, which goes all the way back to Abraham and Sarah, we're saying we have a national history. We didn't start out as slaves in Egypt. We started out in this land. This is where we come from, and this is where we belong. So our identity goes all the way back. Look to your history, see where you've come from, and understand your true potential. Now Hashem, by doing that, removes the shame of Egypt. Now we are ready to eat the produce of the land. Now we're ready to celebrate a Korban Pesach. Now we're ready to say we are descendants of Abraham and Sarah. So in one sense, we look at our history in a positive way. And that gives us a sense of our possibilities. But now we come to the passage we quote in the Haggadah, which is source number 5 from the end of Yehoshua. The other end of the book of Yehoshua. It's the end of his life. Yehoshua is dying. And he reveals to us our possibility in the negative. He addresses the nation and he says, "Your ancestors were idolatrous." And it's true. And it's not just Terach, father of Avraham. You know, God willing, in another week and a half, we're going to produce our Seder Companion, and you'll see it in the shuls. So Yaron Peretz wrote an article in the Seder Companion in which he noted it's not just about Terach and Avraham, because Terach's family is the one that gave us Sarah as well, right? We have the idolatry on both sides. And not only that, they gave us Rivka and they gave us Rachel and Leah through that family. Additionally, it's our whole family that goes back to the worship of Avodah Zarah, the worship of idolatry. That is also our possibility. It's the flip side of what Yehoshua said positively in chapter 5 when he said, "Look, you can become great, you can become like Avram and Sarah, that's your origin." We can also be Terach and Nachor. We could also be Lavan and Betuel. And all the decisions we've made since the time of Terach, from the decision of Avraham and Sarah to travel to this land to listen to Lech Lecha, to Rivka's decision making sure that the blessing would go to Yaakov, to the sale of Yosef, to Nachshon ben Aminadav jumping into the sea, to Moshe defending the Jews after the golden calf. All of those decisions brought us to the day when we entered our land of Israel, but again, the egg can be unboiled. We could go back to become like that again. And so maschil bignus, we start with our shame. In the beginning of the Haggadah, we say, "Mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu," our ancestors worshipped idols. There's an "I remember when" that is a negative. It's the sense that we could be idolaters again. But it's still a positive for our Seder. Even if what I'm remembering at the start of my Seder is that I come from idolatry, that potential is within me, it still teaches me something that's a positive, which is the value of the decisions that we've made all along. Because we climbed out of that genus, of that disgrace. The acts of millions of human beings across the generations have brought us not genus, not shame, but shevach, not disgrace, but honor. And this study of possibility reminds us to never abandon hope. We were slaves, as Shmuel notes. We were idolaters, as Rav notes, and we canceled both identities. And in our future, no matter how deep our exile, we must always know that we experienced that genus, that shame in the past, and we climbed out, and that we certainly will do so again. Thank you very much. I'm going to use my remaining 1 minute just to remind people again to sign in. I'm going to add one more sign-in sheet at this end of the table. If people could pass the sheets around, then you will get the link for... You don't need to put in your address if you already get emails from us, but you do need to put in your name. That way we'll know to send you the link to the audio recordings from tonight and from Shaarei Shamayim. Thank you. Okay. Something always has to go wrong with the copy machine. So if you have the single sheet of mine, which has the silent story, then you have all the sources. If you have the stapled one, you're missing half of it, because it only stapled one side of it. I don't know how that happened. It doesn't matter. It's okay. We'll follow along, whether you have the sources or not. Okay, so Seder night, we have a few central mitzvot to the night, or at least as we classically understand it. We have one which takes the significant percentage of our night, which is Magid, the story of telling our children, telling ourselves, telling everybody about the tale, about the narrative, the story of the Exodus, the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. And then, at about whatever percentage through your Seder, depending on how long Magid goes, we have our other series of mitzvot, rabbinic and biblical, eating matzah, eating maror, where the only sound you should be hearing at that point, it's not exactly silent, but you know, it's loud chewing on crunchy matzah, on lettuce, whatever the case may be, but we're no longer talking. But that's basically our two components. Our two main mitzvot in the Seder. Later on, we have some others in Hallel. But those are our two central mitzvah moments at the Seder. And we take it as a given that one of those mitzvot is verbal, is communicative, is lively, has questions and answers. That's Magid. He got Delavincha, tell your children. And then there's the active component, which while the narrative part of our night frames it historically, frames it philosophically, it's distinct from that mitzvah. And that's how I always understood the mitzvah, and to be fair, that's still, I think, the majority position. I gave you here, if you have the, this is on all the source sheets, but there are many, many psukim from which we derive this. Whether it be the first source here from Perek Yud Bedin in Shmot, Vayakim Yomru Alechem Neichem Ma Avodazo Lachem, when your children will ask you, what is this work to you? V'amartem Zevach Pesach Hu LaHashem, and you'll tell them that this is the Passover sacrifice that we bring to to God, Asher Pasach Al Batei V'nei Yisrael B'Mitzrayim, because God passed over, or whatever exactly Pesach means, but he passed over the houses of the Jews in Egypt when he struck down the Egyptians, or whether it be source 2, Vayomer Moshe Lam Zachor Dayom Azer Sheitzata Mimitzrayim Beit Avadim, remember this day when you left Egypt. Or in 3, the most famous, V'higata Levincha Bayom Ahu Lemor Ba'avur Zeh Asa Adonai Li B'tzeiti Mimitzrayim. You will tell your children on that day that it is because of this that God took us out of Egypt. And it goes on, I gave you 5, 6. And like I said, the classic understanding of this mitzvah is the way the Rambam presents it in number 7. I gave you the whole thing, I'm not going to read it all, but just the beginning. Mitzvat Aseh Shel Torah L'Saper B'Nisim V'Niflaot She'Nasu L'Avoteinu B'Mitzrayim B'Leil Chamisha Asar B'Nisan. It is a biblical, positive commandment to discuss, to tell the story of the miracles and wonders that happened to our forefathers in Egypt on the night of the 15th of Nisan, Shne'emar, Zechor Yom Azer Shatim Mitzrayim, K'mo She'Nemar Zechor Yom HaShabbat. And then he goes on to prove it. And in Bet, he tells you, Mitzvah lo di labanim afilu lo shalu. And there's a commandment to tell your children even if they don't ask. And if you go through the Rambam, this is how we do it. That whether your children want to know, they don't want to know, they ask, you have a proactive mitzvah to tell them. We assume that by the time they get to the Seder, no matter how young they are, even if they're barely verbal, at this point they will ask you the Manishtana, and you'll answer, right? I know my 2-year-old doesn't really know what the words mean. He can't really use so many words, but Manishtana he knows. And we respond and we tell the story, each child at his own level. Every year, when I'm preparing for Pesach,
I find a source that just throws me for a loop. So this year it was a piece by Rabbeinu Asher, 13th century, Baal HaTosfot, one of the most important Rishonim of halachic authority, one of the three authorities upon which Shulchan Aruch is based, the code of Jewish law is based. And he has a short response somewhere. I'm sorry to the people of the stapled ones. You won't have it, but I'll read it outside. He says this is not true. It's all wrong. You think that half of your Seder has to be verbal? It's absolutely untrue. If you wanted to, you could have a silent Seder. So then what exactly does V'higadah Levincha Bayom? What does it mean? Tell your children. What does it mean? Remember. What does it mean? What does that mean? If you could have a silent Seder, how could you do that? So this is what he writes. Shesha'alta, you asked me, Lama ein mevarchin al sipur ha-hagadah? Why don't you make a bracha? Why don't you make a blessing on the Haggadah? And this is what he answers. Harbei dvarim tziva ha-kadosh baruch hu la'asot zecher litziat Mitzrayim ve'en anu mevarchin alayhen. There are many things which God commanded us to do, zecher litziat Mitzrayim, in commemoration of the Exodus, that we don't bless, we don't make blessings on. Kigon, hafrashat becharot, such as the separating of the firstborns. V'chol hamoadim, and all holidays. She'ein sarich lahazkir behafrashat becharot, shanosin oto zecher litziat Mitzrayim, when we redeem our firstborns, we don't say, we don't make a bracha, we did this for, because of the whole Egypt background to it. God told us to do something. And through that we remember Egypt. It doesn't mean you have to say anything with your mouth. Ela im yishal. If your child asks for clarification, mifarshin lo, so you explain what you're doing. V'zeu ha-Haggadah, levad shezochrin yitziat Mitzrayim. This is Haggadah, besides for the fact that we remember and commemorate leaving Egypt. So the Rush, like, denies all this, and he says it's not true. You know when you fulfill the story? When you eat the matzah, the maror, the carbon pesach. Not when you tell the story, but when you do the actions. Now, what exactly is he saying? So here, I think, you could take it in two very different ways. So, every year I also have a source that I go to find new things. This year, it was an excellent website, which you want to find wonderful things. I gave it to you here, it's alhatorah.org, and they have a Haggadah section, where they have just articles and insights and paintings on every part of the Haggadah, to enhance your Seder. Excellent. You can go look there later. So they cite this position of the Rush, and the way they understand it there is that they maintain the notion that the mitzvah on Haggadah night is to tell the story. They simply argue what the Rush means is that if a picture, as they write, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a dramatic reenactment might be worth even more. And they argue that the basic notion that Seder night is about telling the story is agreed upon by everyone. The question is, do you need words? The Rambam thinks you need words, and the Rush says no. Words are level one, pictures are level two, reenactment, a play, even if mimed, is level three. Now, if obviously the children don't understand it and they need clarification, so clarify. But fundamentally, the Rush thinks the night is about narrative and there are many ways of telling a story, some with words and some without. But in the minute I have left, I want to suggest the Rush means something very different. That would make sense if the Rush only spoke about Seder night. But what were the Rush's examples? Redeeming, separating the firstborns, and all holidays. When you separate the firstborns, in what sense is that zecher litziat Mitzrayim? It's not Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim in the sense that a picture is worth 1,000 words and reenactment is worth more. What does it mean to say that separating the firstborns because God saved our firstborns and not the Egyptians? In what sense is that a Zecher?
Gratitude?
Acting godly.
So, I'll put it in one English word. It's not remembering, it's commemorating. They are commemorations. They're, right? They're not telling a story. They're acts that we do which instantiate that historical reality, right? They're not telling the story, they're giving it meaningful reality. And I think the Rush is telling something very radical. He's saying, you know what it really means to remember Mitzrayim? It doesn't mean to tell the story. It means to live a life that reflects the recognition that we went out of Egypt. And therefore, when I separate my firstborns, I don't remember the story. I live with the consciousness that our firstborns were saved and the Egyptians were not. And to expand this, all the ethical mitzvot that the Torah says, be nice to the widow, the orphan, the stranger, because you were in Egypt. That's not remembering. That's living a life with the consciousness that I was once a stranger and therefore it changes how I live. And I think that's what the Rush introduces to Seder night. It's not about telling a story. I eat matzah not to remember that I went out of Egypt, but to become the person who left Egypt. I eat the Karban Pesach to be that type of person, that I'm part of that nation. And that experience, not to simply remember it, but to live a life which by its definition commemorates and lives and experiences what it means to be the nation who left Egypt. That's what Seder night is about. If your children ask, well, what history got us to this point? So tell them. But more important than remembering the history is living with the feeling and experience that it happened, that you are the result of that historical experience. And that's why Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim is equally true of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, and separating the Bechorah and all the ethical mitzvot, because that's what it means to say, Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo, that you saw yourself as you went out of Egypt, not simply to remember it, but to live a life that is a permanent commemoration of that event and all the messages it carries with it. And now we go to our fourth. Thank you. Chag Kasher V'Sameach.
Good evening. Okay, I'm on the clock. So if you have the sheet entitled, Why Does Eliyahu Come to the Seder? We're going to talk about, I don't know if it where it reached or where it propagated, but if you have it, great. If not, it'll still be clear. Why does Eliyahu come to the Seder? That's really what I want to deal with. And, as a kid growing up, you say, Shvoch Hamadcha, right? And you have to go open the door, and it's for Eliyahu. And if you're lucky, then your parents got the trick cup where you put in wine and it dribbles into the bottom. And my family tried it one time, and wine ended up all over the table, and it was an absolute disaster. And so that was funny. But the question that I want to deal with is, why are we doing this? Why is Eliyahu part of the Seder? Eliyahu seems to crop up in interesting places. He's at a Brit Milah, he's at the Seder. Why is he at these places, and what exactly does this mean for us in the context of the Seder? So, the first component of this has to be that Eliyahu has a unique end-of-life story in Tanakh. The Tanakh describes that he didn't die in the conventional sense. He went up into heaven in a fiery chariot, whatever exactly that means metaphysically, but it means that he's available to come to things. He might show up. That presumably is part of the story here. And as we'll see afterwards, this is confirmed by Tanakh. Eliyahu is coming back at a certain point in history. He's going to have a role to play. So presumably this is part of the background. I want to progress through a few possibilities, a couple of interesting ideas, and then, which I'm not sure are the fundamental reason, and then what I think might be the fundamental reason afterwards. So source number one is an idea from the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon says, we have a debate. There's a debate in the Talmud, different versions of the text in the Talmud, about whether there's supposed to be a fifth cup on the night of the Seder. We're not sure. Some people actually do it, some people don't. And so the Vilna Gaon says, we don't know if you have to have a fifth cup, but we know the Talmud describes in many places that if you have some debate and you're not sure how to resolve it, we set it aside and wait for Eliyahu to come and tell us what the resolution is. So maybe that's what we do. We fill a cup for Eliyahu, and we invite him in to come and tell us if we're supposed to be having a fifth cup or not. One possibility in source number one. Source number two, Rabbi Moshe Chagiz in the Shtei Halachim suggests that this mitzvah, or the fact that we're inviting Eliyahu in to witness the mitzvah, the mitzvot on the night of the Seder, relates to the other time when we invite Eliyahu, which is at a Brit Milah. You're supposed to, as part of the halachas of the Korban Pesach, are that you cannot have a Korban Pesach unless everyone in the household has Milah. And therefore, when Eliyahu comes and he sees that we're doing the Seder, it's not so applicable today because we don't have a Korban Pesach, but he sees that you're doing the Seder, so he testifies, oh, this is a household where everyone fulfilled the mitzvah of Brit Milah, which enabled them to fulfill the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, and he testifies about the double mitzvah, and so he sort of comes in a roundabout way, because he is associated with Mila, and he comes into the Seder in that way. I just added for you here that certain people had a tradition to escort Eliyahu far out of the house. The Nodi Yehuda would escort him to the steps of the house, and apparently the custom of Bel's Hasidim is to accompany Eliyahu to the nearest shul. So if you're looking for an excuse to go for a walk during the Seder, this is how you can do it. Okay, so that's the second possibility. Now I want to get to, so those are some ideas, I want to get to what I think is fundamental. Exactly did it happen that Eliyahu came to be associated with the Seder? And this begins with what we see described here in source 3. The Seder night is called Leil Shimurim, which, depending on how fancy you want the translation to be, could be a night of guarding, could be a night of vigil, however you want to translate it. But the idea is that the night has some sort of special quality. God is watching over us in an extra special way, and therefore we mark the night. It's part of what sets it apart from the other nights of the year. And God is taking care of us in a special way. And the Shulchan Aruch notes that this is the reason for why we say Shvoch Chamatcha. Shvoch Chamatcha is a very interesting paragraph where we ask God to pour out his wrath upon the enemies of the Jews, and it sounds a little bit vengeful. I believe Rabbi Strauchler is discussing it tomorrow night at Cherish Maim, if you want to find out more about it, and tomorrow's Haggadah night. So we say Shvoch Chamatcha for this reason, because of the notion that there's a Leil Shimurim. This is what we have in source number four. We remember that it's a night of Leil Shimurim, and therefore we open the door. We know that nobody's going to harm us. You know, opening a door is not a great security idea, generally speaking, depending on the neighborhood you live in. And we say, Shvoch Chamatcha, we're praying, we want Mashiach to come and pour out his wrath, or Mashiach will come, and God will pour out his wrath on those who deny God, and this is what we want to do at the night of the Seder. Okay, so that's nice. What does that have to do with Eliyahu HaNavi? What we discover is that Eliyahu HaNavi is part of this process, part of the process of the Mashiach coming, and the great judgment which God is going to judge all the nations with includes Eliyahu HaNavi. That's what you have. This is what I meant before, what I mentioned before, that Eliyahu Navi is definitely coming back. It's mentioned in Tanakh, in source number 5. This is from Sefer Malachi. And Malachi says, Hinei anochi sholeach lechem et Eliyahu HaNavi lifnei bo yom Hashem hagadol v'hanara. Behold, I am sending to you, I'm sending to you Eliyahu HaNavi before the day, before the day, the great and awesome day, that day of judgment comes. Eliyahu HaNavi is the harbinger of the Mashiach. He's going to come before this day of judgment. So presumably, the idea here is that Eliyahu HaNavi is tied into this notion of Leil Shimurim, this notion that God is going to judge the world and to spill out his wrath upon the other nations of the world. And in fact, that is explicitly referenced in a midrash, which you have in source number 6. Source number 6 notes, this is from Shmo Rabbah, that why exactly is this a night of guarding? Why is the night of the Seder called Leil Shimurim, a night of guarding? Because throughout history, different historical salvations of Jews, famous ones, have happened on the night of this night of Leil Shimurim. So these include the leaving Egypt, Chizkiyahu being saved, presumably from Sancheriv and the army, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were saved from the fiery furnace, Daniel was saved from the lion's den. All these things happened on Leil Shimurim. It's part of the special quality of the night. And ultimately, at the end, Bo Mashiach ve'Eliyahu mitgadle. At the end of time, Mashiach and Eliyahu will be raised up on this night of Leil Shimurim. So we have a Midrash which explicitly connects Eliyahu and the night of the Seder. Thematically, we have a connection between God doing this judgment to the nations and Eliyahu who's supposed to come before that happens. And so presumably this is the connection. Somewhere between this Midrash and the practice of saying Shvot Shvot Chamadcha, Eliyahu is thematically linked into the Seder. He's coming to the Seder. We want him to come because he's part of this greater process. That's a very intense kind of idea. We're waiting for God to spill out his wrath upon all of the other nations. And whatever you want to do with that philosophically, you will. But I was wondering if we couldn't also include a little bit of a softer, perhaps, idea as well, which is to consider the next pasuk in Malachi. Malachi says Eliyahu is supposed to come, but he also has a task. He's not just showing up to drink the wine. He has a task. What is the task? The task is v'heshiv lev avot al banim v'lev banim al avotam penavov hiketi et haaretz cherem. The goal of Eliyahu Hanavi is to create tshuva, a specific type of tshuva, to return the hearts of sons to their fathers, the hearts of fathers to their sons, lest Bnei Yisrael be caught up in this judgment that God is going to do to all the nations. What exactly does that mean? It's interesting language. To return the hearts of sons to the fathers, the hearts of fathers to the sons. So in the last source here, we have Rashi's explanation. Rashi says, "V'hashiv le'avod, you shall reconcile parents la'chadosh baruch hu, to God." What does this mean? Al banim, the way that the parents are going to be stimulated to do tshuva is al yedei banim, through children. Yahweh will tell the children with love, with desire, go and tell your parents to hold on to the ways of God, go tell them to do tshuva, and he'll do the same thing with the parents to the children. He'll convince the children to convince their parents to do tshuva, he'll convince the parents to convince their children to do tshuva, everyone will do tshuva, it'll be great. What does this have to do with the Seder? I think maybe there's something very nice here, something very profound here. The Seder is about generational unity. We remember the redemption. We start the Seder by recalling the redemption that happened to our forefathers way back when, ancestors a long time ago, were redeemed from Egypt. By the end of Magad, we make a bracha at the end, and we say, Asher ga'alanu v'ga'alat avotenu, who redeemed us, and who redeemed our forefathers. Similar to what Rabbi Ziering was mentioning, there's a notion of feeling personally part of this redemption. And so there's a sort of intergenerational unity. The same experience that our forefathers had of redemption is the same experience we have. A father and a son, children and parents, are sitting at a Seder, and they may be different. They have different life experiences. They grew up in different ways. And at a certain level, it's hard to communicate. But there's a certain level of unity. There's a unity which connects these generations together. This unity of redemption, of God pulling us out of a mundane, meaningless life and charging our lives with connection to Him. This idea that even though we have different kinds of life experiences, all generations are seeking God. That is a sort of intergenerational unity that happens at the Seder. And maybe for that reason, it's very appropriate that we're seeking Eliyahu. This is what we're waiting for Eliyahu to do, to come and create this kind of unity, so that fathers and children who might be very different from each other, different generations, can find this place where they connect, this overlapping reality which they all connect to, of having this relationship with God. So those are a few ideas about why Eliyahu might visit us at the Seder. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow night at Shari Shemayim at 8 o'clock, if you signed in, then even if you can't make it tomorrow night, you'll be able to get the thing to the audio.